Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Jessica Walter died last month. She was 80 years old. Her family says she passed away in her sleep. In a career that spanned over 60 years, she played more than 120 parts on screen. So the odds are you've seen Jessica Walter in something. Maybe it was as Lucille Bluth on Arrested Development, or opposite Clint Eastwood in Play Misty for Me. Or maybe you heard her voice as Mallory Archer on the animated show Archer. It's a personal favorite of mine. You'll hear more about her many, many credits in a second. We're going to replay my 2014 interview with Jessica Walter. But I just want to say that she was an absolute treasure. It was such an honor to speak with her, and she was as generous and kind and warm as you could hope from her performances. Anyway, here we go. From 2014, my interview with the late Jessica Walter. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. The casting call for the part of Mallory Archer on FX's animated comedy Archer said the creators were looking for, this is a quote, a Jessica Walter on Arrested Development type. So needless to say, when Jessica Walter from Arrested Development's agent got it, she called her client. No audition was necessary. Walter's character, Mallory Archer, is the owner of an independent spy agency. Her son, Sterling, is the agency's greatest spy. He's a little bit like 007 if 007 sort of had to deal with the fallout from all of his sex and drinking and indiscriminate violence. In this scene from the show, Sterling, the son, is confronted by his mother, played by my guest Jessica Walter. He thinks he might have figured out who his father is, and he thinks that that father might be the head of a rival spy agency, or a different head of a different rival spy agency.
Well, if you'd let me...
Yeah, tell me how my father might be Nikolai Jakov, head of the KGB, or Len Trexler, head of Odin. I assume those are my only choices. Who else?
Gene Krupa.
What?
No, wait.
The drummer?
Not Krupa, the other one with the teeth. What? Buddy Rich.
Oh, my...
I could never say no to a drummer.
Could you say no to anybody?
I said no to plenty.
Walter's most recognized these days for playing Lucille Bluth on Arrested Development, but she also starred in Clint Eastwood's Play Misty for Me, Sidney Lumet's The Group, and literally hundreds of television shows and plays and basically everything else an actor can do over her 50-some years of acting. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show, Jessica. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. that made me laugh, that clip. I forgot about it.
It's funny. Adam Reed was on the show. He's the creator of Archer, and he was on a year or two ago. And one of the things that he told me, Archer is a very vulgar program.
Racy. We don't say vulgar. We say racy.
Okay. It is. I would say that it's both racy and vulgar. It's both of those things. He told me that he wasn't 100% sure you knew all of the racy things you were saying, and that he would have felt bad if he told you what they were. I'm paraphrasing from memory.
I know what you're talking about. No, because I don't. Half the stuff I don't know what they're talking about, and I just say give me a line reading, which of course you know most is verboten. You never give actors line readings, but some of them I don't want to know what they mean, so he gives me line readings.
But I presume you know who Buddy Rich is.
Oh, well, yeah. I thought you meant the racy stuff. Of course. You know, my husband is a drummer, Ron Liebman. So, yeah, I thought you meant the racy stuff. Like, there was one recently, Boom Chicka Boom Boom, it was written. And I said, what is that? And Adam said, he said, it's a porn signature or something. So I said, well, just, I don't want to know. Just do it and I'll imitate it. And he did it.
You went to the LaGuardia High School in New York, which was and is the sort of great performing arts high school of the United States. Did you go with the intent of making your life as an actor when you were, you know, 13 or 14 years old, however old you were when you decided where to go to high school?
You know, and in my day, it was called High School of the Performing Arts. It became LaGuardia way later. I always wanted to be an actress, and I auditioned for PA. We called it PA. With that in mind, and when in those days, it was high school was grades 9, 10, 11, and 12. So I had 4 years there and absolutely wanted to continue and persevere and did.
What was the first big part you got in high school?
In high school, I sort of became a heroine because they were doing Cinderella, a play, adapted play of something of Cinderella, and the woman playing the wicked stepmother got sick at the last moment. So I, who wasn't even in the senior class, jumped in and learned the part like overnight. And that was my first big part in PA.
And were you typecast for a lifetime?
Yes. Hey, good point. I think I never thought of it that way, but I think I was. Yeah, true. Oh, dear.
I was reading interviews with you that you'd done around Arrested Development and around Archer, and a lot of folks asked you about being cast in those roles. And then I happened upon this interview with you and your husband from People magazine in the mid-1980s when you were newly married.
Yes.
And one of the things they mentioned was the way that your voice and the fact that you were sort of tall and beautiful got you cast as mean moms starting from when you were like in your early 30s.
It's true. You know something? The first person that I ever played mother to was Kim Cattrall, the beautiful, wonderful actress. And I was 36 and she was like 23. Now go figure.
You've played basically 10,000 roles, especially in the 60s, 70s, and 80s on TV. And so we were just sort of going through your filmography and we just picked something.
Uh-oh.
This description was written by my producer, Julia. Here's Jessica Walter as a saloon girl in The Name of the Game, a series from the late 1960s and early 1970s. Let's take a listen to you on this Western, The Name of the Game.
Marshall, you wanted to see me?
I want to talk to you about your morals, Allie.
I don't understand.
I've heard that you've been consorting with a man. Have you been letting a man come into your room after dark?
Just you, Marshall.
Do you remember that particular one?
You know, I think I do, but that I ever got a job after that. It's like amazing. But that was Warren Oates, a wonderful, wonderful character actor who died way before he should have.
One of the great roles in your career was Play Misty for me, Clint Eastwood's first feature film.
Yeah.
As a director. It's from 1971.
Right.
Eastwood starred in it. He was a radio DJ, for folks who don't remember, at a jazz station in Carmel. And you were a woman who called in regularly to the show, and he sort of realized was a stalker. And so we're going to listen to a scene. We're going to listen to a scene from the film. So
I hope it's better than the last thing you played. Okay.
In this scene, Clint Eastwood's character Dave hasn't heard from your character Evelyn for a while, and as we tune in, he's on the air on the radio station.
Caramel, Dave Garver. Hello.
Play Misty for me. I didn't mean to shake you up, I'm sorry. Pretty stupid of me. I've been released. Therapy. It was a bad dream, but it's over.
Where are you?
The airport, San Francisco. I've only got a minute or two between planes. Got a job in Hawaii.
You're all right then, huh?
Fine, David, fine. I just want to say how sorry I am about everything.
Forget it, I have.
I hope so. Because this maiden, she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by you.
Are you near a radio?
No. But play it for me anyway.
I used to work at the opera in San Francisco when I was in high school. And the stagehands there would work on movies when it was an opera season. And because Clint Eastwood lived closer to Northern California, shot a lot of movies in Northern California, they worked on a lot of Clint Eastwood movies. And they would talk mess about everyone else they worked with and just, you know, complain and make jokes and so on and so forth. And then whenever they said anything about Clint Eastwood, they would visibly straighten up and refer to him as Mr. Eastwood. Out of just this deep, profound love and respect that you could just see shining in their eyes. How was it, what was it like to work with this guy when he was, you know, and obviously he was already, obviously he was already a hugely successful actor, but, you know, this was his first film as a director.
He was a wonderful, he is a wonderful person and was just perfect director for me. He just had faith that he had hired the right people. His crews stayed very loyal to him. You know, people from way back then are still on his crews. He's just a lovely human being and very smart as director, very smart. My luck, my good fortune to be in that movie. I never auditioned for it. We met. We talked about, you know, carrot juice and whatever and organic vegetables and in his little office there at Universal. And the next day I got a call, you know, got a call. I had the part. What can I tell you?
Were you afraid about, I mean, not that you would question taking it, but were you afraid about taking on a part like that?
Afraid? No, no, not afraid at all. It was a wonderful role, wonderful. And, I just immediately related to the material. You know, the thing about that woman is that people, I guess, could relate to the story. We've all had those, our hearts broken by relationships that didn't work out. And we all have those feelings of rage and anger and revenge that we want to, you know, wreak upon those people. And we can't do it. So I think when people see characters like that, that's where I think the thing about you want to be the kind of character that people love to hate. Although that never was I afraid of that role.
Let's talk a little bit about Arrested Development, what with it being one of the great television programs of our time. I'll play a clip. I'll start okay. By playing a clip from the show. So this is a kind of a classic Lucille scene from the original run of the show, and it demonstrates Lucille's her single-minded devotion to the things that she is interested in and devoted to, and her obliviousness to everything else. So in this scene, Michael, who is Lucille's son and is played by Jason Bateman, comes into her apartment and he finds her in the kitchen.
Who let you in?
Your new cleaning woman. What happened to Luce?
Supposedly, Luce had to take her daughter to the hospital. That's Lupe, her sister.
God, I hope she's okay.
She's awful. Can barely wash a dish. Uh-oh.
She better not walk through here after she's been in there. Tell me you've got an exit strategy.
Mother.
Oh, please. They didn't sneak into this country to be your friends.
Wow.
Don't you judge me. You're the selfish one. You're the one who charged his own brother for a Bluth frozen banana. I mean, it's one banana, Michael. What could it cost? $10?
You've never actually set foot in a supermarket, have you?
I don't have time for this.
When?
I'm so glad you like it. That's our writing staff that we had, Mitch Hurwitz and our brilliant writers. Believe me, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. That I could tell you.
Man, there are just some great, just straight jokes in that show. Just that misdirection about, oh, she can barely clean a dish. Like that, you could put that. That would be the best joke in any episode of any sitcom ever.
Oh wow!
Just drop it right in. You know what I mean?
Oh my God, that's it. We had such great writers on that show.
Let me ask you, what did you think of as being, you know, the things that Lucille Bluth wanted in those stories on Arrested Development? Like, what was she shooting for?
You know, Lucille, unlike Mallory Archer in Archer, who's a self-made, you know, woman whose money she made for herself and whose success is based on her own abilities, Lucille is not self-made, and her whole MO is to keep up the lifestyle that she's been used to, and the money and the maids, the Lupes and the, you know, Esmeraldas. The conflict for Lucille is to keep that going and somehow, you know, try to be a good mom. And she's really, it's hard to explain, but she's very desperate. And I think if you don't have desperation in comedy, it's not funny. And I think that's why our show, Arrested Development, is so grabs people, because of the desperation of all the characters. You know, Michael is the Jason Bateman character, so desperate to keep his family together. And to have the people love each other and get along, it's the real true example of dysfunctional family at its height, those people. And I think that's what makes it funny. And Lucille, you know, if she can't keep that lifestyle going, she has nothing.
It's funny because you think of a dysfunctional family, especially, you know, in entertainment, as a family that fights all the time, a family that hates each other. And what I hear you describing and what I see on the screen in Arrested Development with Lucille is she's this character who wants to love her family, wants to be the perfect mother, and is simply just wrong about how to go about doing that, and just blinded by her having, you know, lost her footing underneath her, which is someone to hand her a drink at all times and, you know, someone with a feather duster at all times and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. You said it actually better than I did, so I have to think about what that means. You understand it better than I do. You articulate it better than I do. Yeah, exactly right. Exactly. And she says, I love all my children equally. I don't care for Job. You know, she just doesn't know when to stop. You know what I mean? And it's when something that moves her happens or whatever, she says, this is one of my favorite lines, I feel like crying, but I can't spare the moisture. Now that's great writing. That is great writing. I can't take any credit for that.
I think the really central relationship for Lucille, even above and beyond her relationship with her husband or her relationship with Jason Bateman's character, who is sort of the center of the show, is her relationship with her son Buster.
Buster, my Buster.
And Buster is a sort of very sweet, childish character, and he basically acts like a baby.
Very dependent. Very dependent on mom. And she enables that because she needs to have that in her life. She needs to feel that someone really needs her that blindly and openly. But, you know, in the final episodes there on Netflix that were recently run and are still on Netflix, it comes to a conclusion where, you know, Lucille tells Buster he's got to grow up and that she can't be the, you know, the the giant hand, quote unquote, because he has a big giant fake hand, for those listeners that don't know what I'm talking about. She can't be that.
Well, his other hand got bit off. It's a long
story. His hand, yeah, but his hand got bitten off by a loose seal. LOOSESEAL. How's that for writing?
I don't know. B minus.
That's pretty interesting.
I'm laughing pretty loud though to be criticizing it.
But that's, you know, and she lets him go. She says, "You have got to go." In these latest episodes.
We'll have the rest of my interview with Jessica Walter in just a moment. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Fidelity Wealth Management. VP Dylan Sanders shares why it's important to understand clients' values.
People quantify dreams differently. So it's essential to be able to sit with a client and listen and ask questions and just begin to understand what it is in their life that they want to pursue and help them create a roadmap to get there.
To learn more, go to fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE, SIPC.
Whether you're looking to discover a new series to binge, find your next great read, or check out that movie everyone's talking about, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is your guide to all things entertainment. Every weekday, we keep pop culture in high spirits. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
We are the host of My Brother and Me, and now, nearly 10 years into our podcast, the secret can be revealed. All the clues are in place, and the world's greatest treasure hunt can now begin.
Embedded in each episode of My Brother and Me is a micro clue that will lead you to 14 precious gemstones all around this big, beautiful blue world of ours.
So start combing through the episodes. Let's say starting at episode 101 on.
Yeah, the early episodes are pretty problematic, so there's no clues in those episodes.
No, not at all.
The better ones, the good ones, clues ahoy.
Listen to every episode repeatedly in sequence. Laugh if you must, but mainly get all the great clues. My Brother and Me, it's an advice show, kind of, but a treasure hunt, mainly. Anywhere you find podcasts or treasure maps, My Brother and Me, the hunt is on.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Right now, we're looking back on the life and work of Jessica Walter, who died last month at 80. Walter was a brilliant actor who played in hundreds of film and television roles. You might know her best as Lucille Bluth on Arrested Development. She also voiced Mallory Archer on the animated series Archer. She and I talked in 2014.
Let's play another clip from Archer.
Okay.
Which, incidentally, I will never hesitate to say this on the air, is one of my absolute favorite television programs. Maybe my favorite TV show.
Oh, wow. That's a compliment.
Couldn't love it more. So this is from the new season, which essentially the entire team is forced to stop being spies. And this is the instigating incident. They've all been arrested. They're all in separate holding cells, and they've all vowed not to throw the other ones under the bus by volunteering any information. They've all volunteered information. But luckily, two of them, Archer and Lana, have volunteered information as part of a ruse that ends up, you know, they end up breaking everyone else out. And so everyone is in the hallway about to bust your character, Mallory, out of this interrogation room and then, you know, try and figure everything out. And that's the point where we pick up. Your character is in the interrogation room and you seem to be about to confess to everything in exchange for immunity.
Nobody move! Or...
What the hell are you doing?
Getting us out of here!
I've already done that! Let him go! And you'll just have to put that on my... whatever, crime tab.
No. Taking a federal agent hostage is a separate charge.
Oh, well then perhaps we should get him back on the phone.
I don't... There's no need to bother the... look, if you'll just sign this form...
Do, in lieu of criminal prosecutions for... to treason, I hereby forfeit ISIS headquarters.
And also agree to permanently cease and desist any and all ISIS operations.
Or face a mandatory sentence of life in federal prison without parole.
Are you kidding me?
Signed, Mallory Archer.
Oh, my God.
No, nope. Because correct me if I'm wrong, but that entire document is completely unenforceable.
I correct you. You are wrong.
For God's sake, Sterling, it's the government. Even if it weren't legal, they'd enforce it.
Hey, save it for 4-9 to the Supreme Court.
Oh, shut up.
So when you do the show, I'm sure that the same things that make playing an imperious bee, I will say for public radio purposes, fun, or the bad guy or bad gal fun, are doubly fun when you get to do them in the context of voice work, where you get to go big when you want to go big.
Yes, broad. And you know, with voice work, you have to have a lot more energy. If you ever had the energy with that extra, you know, energy on camera, I mean, you'd be laughed off the screen. It would just be way too large. But it has to have an extra little punch, which is fun, big fun.
Your husband has been on the show. Everyone lives together in a house in the new season of the program, and he is among the people that live in the house.
Right.
And he was introduced just recently, or I believe last season on the show.
Yes.
Do the two of you record together?
You know, we did the first day. We did. And it's so much easier if you don't. So after that, we didn't. But, you know, we'll go down there together, and I'll wait for him to be done, and he'll wait for me to be done. So the family that does voice work together stays together.
He's wonderful on the show. In fact, I want to play a scene of the two of you talking together.
Okay.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I respect that. But comparing ISIS to six Cadillac dealerships is like comparing apples to six Cadillac...
Ron!
What?
Sterling is stranded at the Montreal casino with his pockets turned out, and this is just speculation, some new drug-resistant form of VD.
Really?
And you're in Schenectady again!
I'll be home tonight.
Oh, I know. Because what's tonight?
Tuesday night?
Box seats for the opening of Carmen at the Met.
Babe, come on, I promise. I'll be there.
Well, if you're not, you can just not bother coming home at all.
I'm going to go back to this 1984 People magazine article.
Yes.
My key piece of research that I did for this interview. This is Don Brinkley, who was at the time the executive producer of Trapper John MD, a show that you were on at the time. And he says about your marriage that when he first heard of the marriage between, quote, two very dominant, very volatile personalities, he found himself asking, quote, who's going to listen in this house? ?
Wow. Is that in the article?
That's in People magazine.
Wow. First of all, Don Brinkley and his wife Marge were two of the sweetest people ever living on the earth. He was a producer of Medical Center, and his daughter is Christy Brinkley. So what am I to say now? Who listens? We both listen to each other. Or we would have made it to 31 years. Is that the question?
You matched up to the answer that you gave 29
Oh, what did I say?
Ago.
What did I say?
I was attributing it to you, but it's actually Ron, your husband. He says, we both do. We learned how.
Oh, that sounds like him. He is the best. He really is.
Okay, now I want to talk for a minute about dinosaurs, because you asked me if I remembered dinosaurs, and I definitely remember dinosaurs, which I watched every week with my mother.
When you were like 3.
Not quite. I was okay. 11 or 12.
Okay. Oh, perfect. That perfect audience.
Yes. I was exactly in the dinosaurs' key demographic at the time. And dinosaurs was You know, this was the era where The Simpsons had just exploded. And like The Simpsons, it was sort of a take on the 1950s honeymooners style family sitcom, you know, in the same way The Flintstones was. Only it was giant live action puppets.
Animatronic, yeah. It was animatronic, but with bodies, real people in them.
Yeah, I mean, they were really, really amazing puppets. I mean, they still look pretty darn good 20 or so years later. So we have a scene from Dinosaurs, and you were the mom dinosaur whose name was Fran.
Fran the mama.
Let's take a listen.
The terrible twos. That's an old wives' tale.
So what do I look like, a debutante? Think back, Fran. You've gone through this twice before, Robbie, and then Charlene.
Well, let me see. I remember making little decorative twos for the birthday cakes. And then they were 3 years old. That's funny. I have no recollection of that entire year.
My only disappointment is it lacked the signature catchphrase, not the mama.
Yeah, I have to say a quick funny story about Dinosaurs. So the show went on for about three seasons, and at the end of season two, I got a call from the producer. Well, he wasn't the creator, but he was the producer. And he said, listen, you have options with a contract. They can dump you. You can't dump them, but they can dump you. And he said, we may have a problem, with you continuing as Fran. I said, oh, why? He said, well, we've sent Fran to the dinosaur hospital in London. She's going to have a facelift. Only in Hollywood. And we're going to fix certain things. We're going to change about her face and, her ears. And we just hope, we don't know, that your voice will then fit the new Fran. Yeah, I'm getting palpitations just telling you this story because it's bringing up. And I said, oh, well, thanks for the heads up. And I tell you, for a month, I was in a depressed state. I couldn't think of anything, but oh, my God. And then I got the call. Well, she's had her facelift. We've looked at her. And yes, it's okay. Your voice will still fit the new Fran. You believe this? Seriously, it's almost equal to a voiceover audition I once went on for a commercial for Borden's Milk here in the East years ago. And I got past the regular casting and I went up to the suits, the execs there at BBD&O or one of those places. And they said, we want the moo of a cow that has been happily married for 10 years. Yeah, I had mooed my way right up to this very – and I said, okay, so not 9 – and not 11. 10 years. And I proceeded to do about 25 moos, and I did not get it.
Jessica, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jessica Walter. She passed away last month. Her family has asked that in lieu of flowers, her fans should send their support to the charity Guiding Eyes for the Blind, which is an organization that helps train seeing eye dogs. We'll have a link to their website on the Bullseye page at MaximumFun.org. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created out of the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California, where I recently acquired a bench, thanks to the good people at Abel Auction Company. Thanks for that bench. It's a good bench, paid a fair price. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio and Jordan Cowling are our associate producers. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Production fellows at Maximum Fun are Richard Roby and Valerie Moffett. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is by The Go Team. Thanks very much to them and their label Memphis Industries for sharing it. They've got a new single out, by the way, so, Google The Go Team. Get to jamming. You can also keep up with our show on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. We post our interviews in all of those places. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from The Run-Through with Vogue.
Listen as designers, Vogue editors, and industry icons like Erykah Badu and Florence Pugh have in-depth conversations about fashion and culture. New episodes are released each Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
On Wildcard, the new podcast from NPR, you'll hear people like comedian Jenny Slate reflect on their lives. What is something you think about very differently today than you did 10 years ago?
Dressing. Like, not salad dressing. I've always loved it and I'll never stop. Dressing my body.
That's all part of the new game show Wildcard, only from NPR. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Moms know the ups and downs of life. It's what makes them great subjects for books.
This is one of the things that fiction can do, right? It can give us a window into the battles that each person is waging or facing, but it doesn't mean that we condone her actions.
This week on NPR's Book of the Day podcast, we are discussing books centering mothers. So call your mom, then tune into the Book of the Day podcast from NPR.